Good afternoon. Our third case for today and last scheduled oral argument for September is 11-AP-3009-D, Office of Lawyer Regulation versus Roger G. Merry. Arguing on behalf of Mr. Merry is Attorney Christopher T. Cole. Counsel, you may proceed, Mr. Cole.
May it please the Court, I am Christopher Kolb, and I represent the appellant, Roger Merry. I welcome this opportunity to address the Court on this case. Mr. Merry is innocent of any ethics violations, and I hope through the briefs submitted and the remarks that I will make to you today to convince you of that fact. Making those remarks, it is my perception that I may be at have two disadvantages. The first is my sense that a sense of outrage does not play well in an appellate setting. Nevertheless, that is what I feel concerning the fact that the OLR pursued the main count in this complaint, namely an allegation of lack of candor to the tribunal, even after the facts clearly established that that rule had no application here. The second disadvantage is that with respect to the second ancillary count of the complaint, namely a failure to cooperate, I'm going to ask you to not adopt the finding of fact made by the referee. And I'm aware that there's a deference given to findings of fact made by referees. It's not an unvarying rule. And in this case, it should not be followed. This case, in my opinion, went badly off track, and it did so before I ever became involved. To understand why that occurred, a brief summary of the history of the case may be helpful. This grievance was filed by a former disgruntled adversary of my client in a property dispute in Greene County. The gentleman alleged a number of violations of ethics rules, most of which the OLR did not pursue. However, they did pursue a claim that Roger Merry had violated SCR 20:3.3, the candor to tribunal rule. That rule says that a lawyer may not knowingly make a false statement of fact or law to a court. That allegation was proven unfounded in discovery conducted by the OLR in this case when they deposed heads of both of the two agencies at issue in New Glarus, the fire department and the emergency medical services agency. And the heads of those agencies both said that what Roger Merry had said to the court, namely that they preferred easements to be 14 feet wide so as to accommodate emergency vehicles, was in fact the case. It's what they preferred. It's both at the time of the deposition and at the time of the events in question here. Since Mr. Merry had not made a false statement of fact to a tribunal, that should have been an end to count one. However, he was faced with having to continue to defend that count when, after filing a summary judgment motion on his own behalf saying count one should be dismissed, the OLR modified its theory and took the position that a lawyer could be disciplined under 3.3 for making a truthful statement to a court, provided that he couldn't establish the foundation for his statement. That's a proposition that cannot be reached by a construction of the current rule. It could only be reached if this court were to adopt a new rule, and it should not do so because that would be a terrible public policy. It would subject lawyers across the state to prosecutions for making truthful statements to court. That theory was unfortunately entertained by the referee, and so the case went to a hearing. And at that hearing, we were able to present testimony of one of Mr. Mary's clients who had previously been on the fire department in New Glarus and who told him at the beginning of the representation that the preference was for 14-foot easements. Thus, not only was the OLR's initial theory, namely a clear, straightforward violation of 20:3.3, totally vitiated, their alternate and ill-advised theory that you could be prosecuted for making a truthful statement was also totally contradicted by the testimony and the uncontradicted testimony of Mr. Foster. Notwithstanding this clear evidence, the OLR continued to argue for a violation of 3.3 and has even in briefing to this court said that it disagrees with the finding of the referee who threw that count one out. I'm at a loss to give you a theory as to how they could possibly believe that in light of the facts and law of this case. Fortunately, the referee didn't buy that. He recommended that count one be dismissed. He also, unfortunately, found a violation of the second count, which is the duty to cooperate count.
Now, is that the count that's before us?
Your Honor, I'm going to—I apologize. I'm a little hard of hearing, and I'm going to have to—
I'm sorry. What exactly is before us?
What's before you now is the charge and the recommendation that Mr. Mary be publicly reprimanded for a failure to cooperate with the district committee in its investigation.
That was the second count, right?
That's the second count.
And that is the one that's before us, and that's the one you're objecting to.
That is what?
That is what you're objecting to.
That's correct.
You want count two to be dismissed also.
That is correct, Your Honor.
All right. Why?
The evidence for count two is a stool with three legs. The first leg is testimony by a member of the district committee who asserted that when Roger Mary was interviewed by the committee, he gave inconsistent answers. The second leg is a statement in his pleading by Mr. Mary that he had suggested to the committee that they contact the heads of the fire department and the emergency medical services for confirmation of the fact that what he told the court in Greene County was, in fact, the truth. And the third is the fact that when they asked Mr. Mary, well, how did you know this, he did not provide the name of his client, Mr. Foster.
What did he say?
He said, I talked to a number of people in the courthouse from time to time who were from one or the other of the services. They confirmed it.
Everybody knew it. Is that what he said?
And he said everybody knew it. That's correct.
I understood most of your comments thus far before the Chief Justice started asking questions really went to the first count that was dismissed. I mean, that's what you seem to be discussing. Now we're on the second count. But your very threshold comments were that you thought that there was a faulty finding of fact. I assume that went to the second count. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
What finding of fact is faulty?
The referee found that when Mr. Mary was asked, how do you know that the emergency services prefer 14-foot easements, he was not able, he did not, offer the name of his client.
Are you referring to finding 23 that says Mary's claim that his memory was faulty at this time he was responding to OLR's inquiries and that he could not remember the names of the people from the EMS and the fire department is not credible? Is that the one you're referring to?
That and other gloss in the report on the idea that he could not, if he if it was his own client, there's no way that he could have forgotten or not realized that that would be an issue.
Well, let me tell you a problem that I have and then see if you can address it. You did start out your threshold comments saying that the findings of fact are to be upheld unless they're clearly erroneous. And normally I would think of that as if the referee said the easement in this case involves 12 feet. Huh. I could easily find that the finding of fact by the referee that it was 12 feet was clearly erroneous because everything says it's 14 feet that I understand. No problem. But when the finding of fact is credibility, there is the maxim that credibility is for the trier of fact. So it doesn't seem like the normal finding of fact. How do we accomplish what you are asking? You are asking that we find the referee's credibility determination clearly erroneous. That's a little novel, so how do you get there?
Well, first, I guess I would comment that the referee found in general that Mr. Mary was credible and said so in his report. It's only on this question of whether he recalled the name of his client that the referee came to the conclusion that he didn't, and did so on the basis of an inference. No testimony, but an inference from the fact that it was his own client, so he must have recalled. But that runs counter to everyone's common everyday experience. I know a number of things. You know a number of things without knowing how you learned of them or who you learned them from. I know that the earth isn't flat. I know that George Washington was the first president. I can't tell you how I learned that or who first told me. And if you say to me, Mr. Cole, well, those are things that occurred in your childhood, that's a different matter.
Yeah.
I'm prepared for that question.
You could look it up. Those are facts that are easily found.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Those are facts that are easily found and are not peculiar to your knowledge. They are facts of history, and anyone can find them, whether you were taught that in school or not. Here we have a question of whether he's credible when he said whatever he said, or he's not credible. Now, you can't open up his head to find out the area of credibility and not credibility. You infer credibility from everything that is said at the hearing, right?
Well, yes, and credibility in general the referee found in Mr. Mary's favor.
Right.
It's just one instance.
Right, but it happens to be the only instance that's relevant in this case at the moment.
But here's my response, and it's the second point that I would have made to Justice Bradley. I think that this Court can decide that the inference made by the referee was not a reasonable one.
That it was clearly erroneous as a matter of law.
That's correct. But even if you say that finding was correct, it is still this Court's province to decide whether the facts presented and developed meet the burden of proof. And given that the only item, because with the opportunity, I'll address what I did in my briefs on the first two points, the first two legs of this stool, namely the testimony from the district committee member and the fact that Mr. Mary suggested they contact the agencies for confirmation. Really, all that's left is this inference that he must have remembered the name of his client. And we all forget things, even personal things. I've forgotten events that people close to me remind me of, birthdays or wedding anniversaries. From the trivial to the significant, you do forget, people do forget. And bear in mind that at the time that Mr. Foster told Roger Mary what the agencies preferred in terms of easement was. That was, by his testimony, at the outset of the representation, which was approximately 2 years before this district committee meeting. Now, Roger Mary went to that committee interview knowing that he would have to address the question of whether he'd made a misstatement of fact to the tribunal. But the rule itself does not say you ought to know or you have to be able to explain how you know the truth of your statement. That's not what the rule says.
Counsel, if I may interject, because there is a finding 24 that's also implicated, and I want to make sure that you tackle that. It says, the finding of fact says, rather than supplying relevant and available information to OLR in its investigation, Mary took the position that OLR should find out the information on its own. So that's another finding of fact that you'll have to show clearly erroneous. Perhaps you can...
Yeah, I can address that.
It sounds to me like you're addressing both, but I just want to make sure you...
I can address that right now. There was no testimony from Mr. Grubb, who was the only live witness from the committee, on the point of Mr. Mary suggesting that they contact the agencies. The only reference to that in the referee's report is a paragraph in the answer to the complaint, which Mr. Mary filed on his own behalf, in which he said that he, quote, suggested to the committee that they contact those agencies. If, as the rule says, the question is, were the statements false, what better evidence of cooperation is there than to suggest to them, call those agencies, because they'll tell you that what I said was true. He has a duty, members of the court, to cooperate in an investigation. He doesn't have a duty to undertake it. They hadn't deputized him. Obviously, if they had said, Mr. Mary, we'd like to know more about how you happen to know about this easement width. It's not, in my opinion, a relevant issue because his statement wasn't false. But if they said that, he could have gone back to his office. He could have looked through his file, tried to figure out, how did I first learn this? Who did I talk to? But they didn't do that. They proceeded on this premise that is not supported by the language of the rule, that if you make a true statement of fact, you're not liable. You have not failed. And so he would have no reason going into that interview, knowing that what he said was true and that it could be verified, to think, oh, I'd better check on how it was that I first learned of this.
So if the OLR would charge a violation of the trust account and ask to see everything or have an explanation of why this shows insufficient funds, you think a cooperation would say, you find out. You check the records.
No, absolutely.
I don't have to tell you that. I don't have to check all these records. You do that. You're making the accusation that I willfully failed to provide relevant information. You can check them as well as I can check them. You think that's cooperating?
No, I do not, because in that case, you're accused of violating the trust account rule. You know going to that committee meeting that your records are going to be relevant. The rule here says you cannot knowingly make a false statement of fact. He knew that he hadn't done that. He knew that what he said was accurate. He couldn't recall how he first learned it, but he knew it was accurate. He had no reason going to that meeting to think that we would be in court today because he couldn't remember the name of who told them. But in his mind, and rightfully so, the question remained, well, was what I said accurate or not? And so he suggested to them, if you contact the heads of those agencies, they'll confirm that what I said is accurate. That's cooperating with the committee.
But he didn't call them and confirm it. He didn't get a letter saying, we told you this on the phone, or this is common knowledge, or we told one of your clients this. He didn't get any of that.
I guess I don't see the point of his confirming the truth of what he already knew. It was the committee that wanted to be convinced of it. I am sure that if they had said, Mr. Merry, we want you to go back and find out for us. He would have done it. He might have done it begrudgingly, but he would have done it. But the fact is, he couldn't remember the names, and so he said, here's how you find out the truth of what I said, which is, after all, is the key question. Call the heads of the agencies. I'm sure they'll tell you that what I said was true. That's not a failure to cooperate with the committee. The fact is that the referee at one point...
And he didn't call any of his clients and say, hey, I'm being asked how I knew this. Did you tell me? He didn't confer with any of his clients.
Not before the district committee. He did when we were preparing for trial. And what happened in between was... He filed a summary judgment motion saying, I didn't make a false statement of fact, and the OLR shifted its theory to, well, whether or not it was true, how did you know about it? Well, at that point, it became clear we'd have to find that out. I will tell you that as I was thinking about discussion today, I could not recall whether I learned about Mr. Foster's statement to my client from my client or by talking to Foster himself. If a failure to recall the source of information is an ethics violation, then consider me to be self-reporting.
Did you make inquiry?
Excuse me?
You made inquiry, didn't you? And if I asked you how you found out, you probably would say, I can't remember, but I'll make inquiry. Isn't that what you would say?
Well, if I think, with all due respect, I think that's a false hypothetical, because there you're asking me, and you're saying that the fundamental question that I have as a justice is, how did you know? But when he went to that committee, he didn't know that how he knew would be an issue. He had no reason to think so, given the plain language of the rule.
Plus, isn't the purpose of the rule to tell the truth? And the truth was that the EMS and the fire department both said they preferred 14-foot wide so they can get in and out safely. And I think to the answer to his grievance, he attached a letter from someone from the EMS. And because they didn't specifically say 14 feet, but said we need width sufficient to safely get in and out, that was not sufficient for the OLR. So then they proceeded and went further. But was there ever along the way anybody that said 14 foot wide is not what they preferred?
No.
Didn't the fire department chief, didn't he testify that 14 feet, at least 14 feet is what they want?
Both the head of the fire department and the head of the EMS, or emergency medical services, both testified to that in depositions taken by the OLR.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm looking at the referee's report here. I'm speaking a little loudly to be of assistance. All right. Page 7, the referee says, Mary's claim that his memory was faulty at the time he was responding to OLR's inquiries and that he could not remember the names of the people from the EMS and the fire department is not credible, particularly in light of the fact that one of the individuals who did furnish him information was his own client, Kurt Foster, the same person called by Mary as a witness on his behalf at the hearing in this disciplinary matter. Is that the only basis that we know of for the referee's finding that your client was less than truthful?
Well, as I mentioned, Justice Gableman, there are three legs to this stool of evidence. The first is a statement by a district committee member that Mr. Merry made inconsistent statements.
Right, and I can we see the transcript, and we can decide the difference between. I don't even remember what the purported transcript. I guess I'll have to go find out. Go ahead. The third.
And the second was the suggestion, call the agencies, they'll tell you. And then the third was the fact that he didn't provide the name of Mr. Foster. The referee was obviously troubled by this because it makes no sense that if he had that name, he wouldn't give it. And so what the referee said was, he said it would have been distinctly helpful to his cause for him to give that information, and that's obviously true. he would be stopping that line of inquiry, if he recalled it, to give that name. What the referee concluded was that Mr. Merry must have remembered the name of Mr. Foster and obstinately refused to provide it, and that he was thereby, quote, acting according to his own desires, regardless of the dictates of reason.
And I guess I'm having a little difficulty understanding why it's so important. Who told him? It turns out to be true. What difference does it make who told him the information?
It shouldn't have. It should
is
not.
There no element of materiality to the charge which has been made against your client?
But that's why I said that whether the facts found rise to meeting the level of the burden of proof of clear, satisfactory, and convincing is for you to determine. And what's left of the so-called facts is that he didn't offer the name of his client, Mr. Foster, and that doesn't rise to the level of clear, satisfactory, and convincing evidence. There are all kinds of reasons why you don't remember things. And as Justice Abrahamson said in the Kalal case, 3.3 is not meant to apply to mere forgetfulness, and I think the same is true of the duty to cooperate rule. The mere fact that you forget somebody's name, when it was obviously in his interest, if he had it, to provide it and stop that line of inquiry. The OLR in its brief suggests that Mr. Merry knew going into that meeting that how he knew would be an issue. But they quote from my client's testimony, and I'll read it as two questions and answers. And as you listen to it, you'll hear there's nothing there that goes to the question of how he knew. So the first question is, you were prepared to discuss the 14-foot easement when you walked into this November 11th meeting, correct? Answer, yes. Second question, and you were aware prior to November 11th that one of the issues was the width of the easement and statements that you made to the court? Answer, yes. There's nothing there that indicates he knew, I knew I was going to have to tell them how I knew this, because as you've implied, it's irrelevant. If your statement is true, you can't be found guilty of violating 20:3.3, and he knew it was true. Couldn't remember how he learned it, but he knew it was true the same way that I know that the earth is not flat.
From your childhood?
Sorry?
I'm just kidding. I'm referencing a joke you made earlier.
Oh.
From your youth.
Oh, yes. Well, you know, Justice Prosser,
If hypothetically you were to lose on the second count here, do you challenge the costs at all?
I have, Your Honor, and I've not addressed that in my remarks, but I filed a brief longer than presumably you usually find in cost challenges, because I believe that a significant part of the OLR's costs were related to continuing to pursue the 20:3.3 accusation, even after it was clear it had no application. I would suggest here, in terms of the idea of the difference between not remembering something in childhood and something more recent. As I said, there was about I'm sorry, I see my light on, so I guess maybe I'll defer to my rebuttal 5 minutes.
Okay. All right. Thank you. And thank you for responding to Justice Prosser's question. Kim M. Clark, Attorney Clark, representing the Office of OLR.
May it please the Court, Chief Justice and Justices, my name is Kim Clark. I am retained counsel for the Office of Lawyer Regulation. Thank you for the opportunity today to present OLR's perspective on the appeal filed by Attorney Merry. Litigation in this matter was initiated when OLR filed a 2-count disciplinary complaint against Attorney Roger Merry. 1 count of that complaint alleged that Merry violated SCR 20:3.3A1 by knowingly making a false statement of fact or law to a tribunal. The second count alleged that Merry violated SCR 22.03 sub 6, which prohibits a lawyer from willfully failing to provide relevant information and failing to answer questions fully in the course of an OLR investigation.
Counselor, I'd like to refer to your complaint, and you were the lawyer that drafted the complaint, so if you have it before you, it might be helpful.
Yes.
I'd like to know whether in paragraph 8, the quotation that you represent was made by Mr. Mary in his brief contains an inaccurate representation of fact.
In paragraph 8, I'm talking about July 30th, 2008, when Mary filed that brief to the court. And I think with regard to whether there was a factual basis, whether this was true at the time that he made it, I think that the fact that it was in July of 2008 is important.
Was the statement, emergency medical service and fire department are requesting 14 feet so as to permit access for emergency vehicles, is there a false statement in that quote?
Based on the testimony by Maria Donnell, who was the person who was the head of EMS in 2008, based on the concession by Attorney Mary that the only person who had the authority to speak on behalf of EMS in 2008, it appears that she does not back up that statement that she had preferred or requested a 14-foot easement.
But it turned out to be true.
You're talking about the letter of November 19, 2007 that Mr. Mary attached to his answer to the grievance?
I am talking about...
By Maria Donnell?
No, ma'am. I'm talking about the testimony by Maria Donnell that was given in this case. We took her deposition. I took Ms. Donnell's deposition in this case, and I asked her, and that was an exhibit at the hearing, and I asked her, do you, and this is on page 10, do you remember talking to anybody about requesting a 14-foot easement on behalf of the emergency medical service? Answer, no. Question, do you know where 14, have you ever heard of this 14? Answer, no. Foot requirement or... And her answer was no, no, no. And it seemed like a pretty unequivocal statement by her that she had not communicated to anybody that EMS had requested the 14-foot easement.
He never said that she had, correct? He never said that she told him that. Also, as part of the appendix, you have another statement from Christy Miller of the New Glarus EMS, saying this memo is to clarify EMS's position on driveways and easements. In the fall of 2007, it was EMS' request that all driveways and easements be a minimum of 14 feet in width. This memo is meant to supplement the November 19, 2007 letter of Maria Donald, which never talks about the width, correct?
That is correct.
So I go back to my first question to you. In paragraph 8, is the quote from his brief contain a false statement? That's either a yes or a no, counsel.
Yes, it was inaccurate.
Okay, so you are telling
me... I'm sorry.
Okay, you are telling me that that was not the request of the EMS. That's what you're telling me.
In 2008, the only person with authority to speak on behalf of the EMS was Ms. Donnell, and she did not confirm that she had requested a 14-foot easement. He made that statement in 2008. He later produced that memo in 2010, at which time Ms. Mueller was then the chief of the EMS. Between 2008 and 2010, Ms. Mueller took over responsibility.
Okay. So... it turned out to be true that they wanted a 14-foot easement. Yes?
When Ms. When
no,
Ms.
No, no.
Mueller... When
Ma'am,
Ms.
this time I'm going to insist on a yes or no. This is someone's, you know, these are very serious charges. And I want to cut to the chase. Yes or no, did it turn out to be true that EMS wanted at least a 14-foot easement along that way?
It turned out to be true later.
Okay, and I apologize to my friend and colleague, Justice Rogensack, for interloping on her question, but this case is very troubling to me for several reasons. As far as I understand it, the lawyer made an accurate representation of the court. EMS wants a 14-foot easement, which, having done a number of easement cases when I was a trial court judge, but mainly within the utility context, they want 20-some feet for their trucks. So it doesn't come as a big surprise to me that EMS wants 14. That sounds relatively modest. And then he's asked, well, who told you that? And he says, I don't recall. And somehow based on the idea that his client happened to work for EMS, he's found to be a liar. Is that about right?
He was found to not have cooperated with the OLR.
What basis is there for that determination?
In the referee's report...
Yes. I have it in front of me.
Yes, sir. In paragraph 22, the referee found that... that he failed to furnish the names of any individuals when asked by the grievance committee.
But in order, certainly there has to be an element of intentionality to be violative of the rule, counsel.
In his discussion, the...
Yes, there has to be an element of intentionality, yes.
The referee said that it was deliberate, not accidental, based on the circumstances.
And the circumstances were what?
The circumstances were that, and this is at page 13 in his discussion where he talks about this, Mary's failure to provide the requested identities was clearly deliberate and not accidental. Rather than furnish information that was readily available to him, Mary took the position that the district committee should unearth the information itself. Mary knew the name of his own client, Kurt Foster, and Maria Donnell, who he had previously referenced on two different occasions, once in court on July 2, 2008, when he said she was the only person he had spoken to from EMS.
And second, the investigator, James Carey, that was hired by OLR, do you know if he called up people at the fire department, called up people at the EMS to check out what they really were requesting? Do you know if he did that or not?
I do not know, ma'am.
Okay. And you didn't do that. You didn't make any factual checks.
No.
Okay.
Counsel, here we have violations asserted, and I'm going to forget count one because that's off the table right now. We have violations asserted in count two of 2203 sub 6, and 20:8.4H. Did the referee, with regard to count two, find violations of both of those asserted bases?
Conclusions of law. He states that OLR has shown by evidence that is clear, satisfactory, and convincing that Mary violated SCR 2203 sub 6 and SCR 28.4 sub H.
Okay, and that's in number 5 of the conclusions of law. Is that correct?
Yes, ma'am.
Now, all of the questions, or most of the questions, seem to be focusing on 22.03 sub 6. 20:8.4H indicates that it's a straight failure to cooperate with the OLR, as opposed to 22.03 sub 6, which reads, in the course of the investigation, the respondent willfully failed to provide relevant information, to answer questions fully, or to furnish documents, and the respondent's misrepresentations in a disclosure are misconduct. So 22.03 sub 6 focus on whether or not misrepresentations were made by omission or commission, I guess. 22.84H deals, as I said, with a more generic failing to cooperate. I note in the findings of fact number 24, the referee states, rather than supplying relevant and available information to OLR in its investigation, Mary took the position that OLR should find out the information on its own. I took that to be a finding that comports with asserted violation of failing to cooperate under 20.8.4H. Give me your best argument as to why that finding of fact and that conclusion of law are not clearly erroneous.
In this case, Derek Grubb testified at the hearing, and he was one of the individuals who was at the District 12 committee in November 11, 2009. He testified as to his recollection as to what Mary's answers were to the questions that were posed by the committee members. During that meeting, there was a specific discussion about this 14-foot easement, and committee members repeatedly asked him to provide the identities of the individuals that he spoke to. Different committee members asked him different ways for that information, and he did not provide any of those names. He couldn't recall specifically what the answers were, but he does recall that none of the responses provided gave the information that was requested. There's support that he willfully failed to do that based on the fact, again, that this was his own client, and also that Maria Donnell was somebody he had referenced specifically on two other occasions. Did I answer your question? I may have gotten a little lost in it. I beg your pardon.
I asked with regard to both whether or not the finding of fact was clearly erroneous and whether the conclusion of law, I said, was clearly erroneous, or was an error as a matter of law. Give me your conclusion of law argument.
It is your position, isn't it, Counselor, that he knew the names of the people he talked to, but simply refused to give up the names?
Yes, ma'am, it is.
And you base that on the fact that one of the people that apparently told him they were requesting 14-foot easement was a client of his own?
Yes, in part.
And what's the other part?
This part of it is also speculation on my part, but also the fact, again, we get back to Maria Donnell. Twice he produced her name, and then later on, 6 months later, after he specifically referenced her name in a letter to the OLR, he shows up in front of the district committee and does not again provide that name.
He provided a letter from her, and I think you pointed out in your complaint that the letter doesn't speak to 14-foot wide easements. He provided that letter with his answer to the grievance, correct? So he provided it, but he wasn't representing in that letter that she was the one that gave him that information.
It seemed to suggest that, though.
Well, if it suggested that, and OLR, I mean, why didn't OLR pick up the phone and call her and just ask her, did you ever have a conversation about this, or what are they requesting?
It's not our position that he was burdened with the duty of doing the OLR's investigation. Mr. Mary had the duty and the responsibility to tell the committee what he knew. He had a responsibility and an obligation under the rule to cooperate fully, to answer questions fully, and he failed to do that.
If he knew the name, why in the world wouldn't he just said, Joe Smith told me or Mary Donald told me? I mean, I don't understand what would his motivation have been for going there and knowing he told the truth. I mean, when I read your complaint, frankly, I think the complaint says it was a lie that they were requesting 14-foot wide easements, and that clearly is not the case. At least it's not the case with everything the court now has before it. Whether you had that when you filed the complaint or not, I don't know. But when he went before the district committee, why would he purposely not tell you? I can't imagine a reason.
I'd be speculating as to why, but if you're asking me what my thought is on that, because I've given it some thought. It didn't make a lot of sense to me if he had the information available to him. Why would he not provide it? I think that one explanation, reasonable explanation, for why he would not have provided the information that he had was because he had felt frustration with OLR in the past. I think previously Mr. Mary had contact with OLR and the predecessor agency and felt that he had not been treated entirely fairly. And I think that's somewhat evident in paragraph 3 of his answer to the complaint. He responded to the allegation there where we detail his prior discipline, and he stated the following.
No, you don't need to read it. That's not
okay.
Before us.
Okay.
You know, I'm really concerned about, frankly, about the complaint. I'm concerned about an agency for which I am responsible going forward on a complaint when the allegation is made that it was a false statement to a tribunal, which clearly was focused on the width of the easement. Now that's off the table, and because that wasn't something on which there was an ability for OLR to prevail, now we're after him because he didn't tell him who told him that. And, you know, I'm trying to look at what's reasonable in regard to the report of the referee, and it's a very good referee who I think wrote a very fine report. But I don't see how it's more reasonable to presume he's hiding the names rather than he simply forgot them when he was asked, and maybe didn't want to get accused of making a false representation by saying it was Sam Smith and it turns out to be Mary Jones who gave him the information. I just don't see why it's more reasonable to assume he was refusing to tell the names that apparently would have gotten him off the hook and that would have been the end of it. I have a hard time understanding that.
Counsel, if we could return to my question about the conclusion of law and why it was not erroneous. I know the referee made reference to the Erspommer case. So now I want to talk about law and why the kind of allegation that's set forth in 20.8.4H, whether or not that's a meritorious assertion and how it involves the Erspommer case and other cases that may have been cited in support of the referee's conclusion of law cited by the referee.
In Erspommer, and I'm just looking through my notes, in that particular case, I think it's significant because in Erspommer, the licensee or the respondent cooperated the way he wanted to cooperate. The OLR investigator in that case wanted to speak to him, not in person, but over the phone, and wanted to ask him questions that way. And there was a specific reason that he wanted to do that, and it was because there were some concerns about mental health issues. And so the investigator asked him several times to speak to him on the phone, and Attorney Erspommer decided and told him that, well, I'm only going to answer your questions in writing. And in that case, this court found that that was failing to cooperate. So essentially in Erspammer, the notion there is that you do not get to choose how you cooperate with the OLR. In this case, Attorney Mary's obligation was to cooperate fully, and that's what is in the rule. And clearly he did not cooperate fully because the referee found that he had this information available to him but did not provide it. So I believe there's a factual basis in the record for that, and that the facts support the conclusion of law that the referee made, because that he had violated 2203.
Because he had the information and did not provide it. But
yes, sir.
As I understand it, now I am actually kind of confused. Is it OLR's position that the failure to cooperate claim stems from the stated lack of recollection, or is it OLR's position that the failure to cooperate claim comes from at some other point where he suggested that OLR should find out? Or none of the above?
No, the first. The fact that he had that information readily available to him, and based upon the circumstances, and this, again, this is a credibility determination by referee Decker.
And the credibility determination is that because he said he didn't remember, and because one of his clients Kurt Foster was his client?
Right.
Was it ever established that Kurt Foster is the one who told him that the EMS needed a 14-foot easement?
I believe Mr. Foster was a former member of the fire department, and ultimately at hearing, Mr. Foster did testify that the fire department wanted, I think he said, 14-foot easement.
As to the answer to my question, though, counsel, was it ever established that it was Mr. Foster who indeed told Mr. Mary that the relevant departments wanted a 14-foot easement?
Mr. Foster said that he told Mr. Mary. Mr. Mary never testified to that.
Mr. Foster testified that he told Mr. Mary that.
Right.
When was that?
During the hearing on September 11, 2012.
Okay, and because Mr. Mary said he didn't remember, I think I have it now.
Okay.
Go ahead, Justice.
The district committee met on November 11, 2009?
Yes, sir.
What was the issue before the committee?
The grievance by Mr. Fabish, and there may have been more than one issue at that time. Ultimately, only two issues were found to probable cause was only found as to two of the issues. I think multiple concerns had been raised by Mr. Fabish. When I questioned Attorney Grubb at the hearing in this matter, we didn't talk about all of the issues that were covered. I just specifically asked him, did the subject of the 14-foot easement come up? And so we focused on that.
Okay. Were all of the issues raised by Mr. Fabish before the district committee?
That I don't know. I apologize.
What was wrong with the answer that was given in the May 1st, 2009 letter from Mr. Mary on page 5 with respect to the 14-foot easement? This is on
Yes, sir, I have it. Yes. Thank you.
Page 120 of your appendix.
In his May 1, 2009 letter, he makes reference to the letter dated November 19, 2007 from the Nuclear's EMS representative, which was Maria Donnell. There is no mention in the letter from Ms. Donnell of a 14-foot easement. All he says is, obviously, the EMS would want a wider easement. So he's clearly suggesting there that the EMS wanted a 14-foot easement. And going back to my deposition of Ms. Donnell, and it was her testimony that we used at hearing, she did not support that. The notion that she had asked for a 14-foot easement, and she's the only person that could have spoken on behalf of EMS at that time.
So she said that they weren't requesting people to have a 14-foot easement, or did you ask her whether 14-foot easement was required rather than requested?
I had asked her if she recalled talking to anybody about a 14-foot easement, and she said no. And when I started to ask her about this 14-foot, she didn't even let me get any farther. She hadn't talked to anybody. It was my clear impression from Ms. Donnell. She hadn't talked to anybody about a 14-foot anything. I mean, request, okay, requirement, preference.
Okay. But she wasn't saying that the EMS did not request a 14-foot easement when you're looking at a driveway access, right?
She just said she didn't talk to anybody about it.
She didn't talk to anybody. Okay. All right. Thank you. That helps. I'm looking at the code, the SCR, and I'm looking at 6.
Chief, I can't quite hear you.
We'll see. Okay. I'm looking at the SCRs, and I'm looking at subsection 6, SCR 2203, sub 6. Okay. This whole SCR references the investigation. Okay, and these are the responsibilities of OLR and the responsibilities of the respondent. And 6 says, in the course of the investigation. Now, it's my understanding that we're talking here about the district committee. And that's part of the investigation. Is that right?
Right.
And that's where the respondent has or has not provided truthful information, right?
That's correct.
Then it says, in the course of the investigation, that would be the hearing before the district committee in 2009, the respondent's willful failure, and the referee found that, right?
Yes, ma'am.
To provide relevant information, and you think the relevant information is who told him, whether it was 12 or 14, because he represented to the court 14, right? Okay. To answer questions fully, and the response here is that he didn't, according to the evidence, didn't answer fully because he didn't say who told him. He just said, you find out. To furnish documents. A document could have been documents from the fire or other departments saying 14 was required. What he provided in his letter was didn't say 14 was required. Right?
Correct.
Okay. So you think that was relevant because that's the whole charge here is he made a representation that 14 was required to the court. Is that right?
I'm sorry, say again.
The representation that is supposedly false was that 14 feet was required.
Was that's requested.
For
excuse
requested.
Me, Chief Justice.
I'm sorry. Was requested.
Okay. Right, and the document he supported at the time did not confirm that.
Okay. So it was relevant information because the big fight was 12 or 15 feet, right?
Right.
And so the question, did he answer questions fully? The district committee thought not, and the referee apparently agreed. Did he furnish documents? He did not, that satisfied for the 14 feet, at least in 2009. Isn't that the time period we're looking at?
Right.
Okay. And his misrepresentation in a disclosure. So the misrepresentation is he told the circuit court 14 feet was what was requested. He didn't have support for that, right?
Well, that was count one, his representations to the court. Count two was representations to the committee.
Okay. So what we have, in the course of the investigation, he did not make full disclosure as required here. So what he did, what the disclosures he did after 2009, why are they relevant to us?
That kind of gets to Justice Gableman's question, is did it turn out to be true? It turned out later to be true, but the relevant time period here is July of 2008 when he's making the representation.
No, I didn't read.
Time,
yeah, not afterwards. This whole thing is designed to get out as much information as possible during the investigation so we don't spend a lot of time on a referee and on appeal. So the issue is 2009. I didn't read the last clause to you. It says in 6, in the course of the investigation, the respondent did any one of these things, regardless of the merits of the matters asserted in the grievance. It doesn't matter whether any of this was true or not. He failed to cooperate in an investigation. So what you have to look at is 2009, not whether it turns out that this grievance is not supported and is or was dismissed.
I think that's a concise statement, yes.
Counsel, in response to the questioning by the Chief Justice that just occurred, you indicated that one of her questions, in your words, kind of went to a point that I made. I respectfully disagree that you have an accurate understanding of any point my question might have exposed. However, I do note the memorandum in the record, dated September 2010, from Chief Mueller of the New Glarus EMS, which states quite unequivocally that in the fall of 2007, it was the EMS's request that all driveways and easements be a minimum of 14 feet in width. And I think in response to the questioning by the Chief Justice, you indicated that certainly would fall within the relevant time period, right?
That would, yes.
So my question is, if what he said is true, that the EMS desires a 14-foot easement, what difference does it make who told him, if it's true?
The only person who could have spoken on behalf of the EMS at that time was Marie O'Donnell, not the chief. I believe he was the chief up until 2010.
Could I ask you, on this 2203 sub 6, is a respondent entitled to assert a privilege against self-incrimination?
In an OLR proceeding, I did not research that particular issue. This is, a quasi-civil administrative proceeding. But in a civil proceeding, if you assert the Fifth Amendment, there is a presumption that the answer you would have given would have been against your interest. Had he asserted the Fifth Amendment, I think, and I'd have to do the research, but I do believe that the referee could have found that the information he would have given would have been contrary to his interest.
Okay. Are there any privileges that a respondent could assert with respect to the answers?
As far as attorney-client privilege?
Attorney-client
something
privilege
communicated
or
to him by Mr. Foster?
Spousal privilege or and any other privilege?
I guess one could always assert the privilege. I apologize. I did not specifically research the issue whether he could assert the attorney-client privilege when asked a question about where he got certain information from.
I'm kind of inferring from your answer that OLR believes that 2203 sub 6 trumps the Fifth Amendment, the 14th Amendment. Am I wrong?
I'm not sure where you're going, sir, and I'm certainly not.
Well, you have to assert the Fifth Amendment if you're going to take it. If you don't, it's waived, except under extraordinary circumstances where you don't have to assert it. So I don't know if that helps you or not. It was not asserted here, was it?
No, there was never any issue
an attorney
privilege raised.
That's not the point. This is a matter of a failure to cooperate.
Right.
Okay. And is asserting the Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination? Well, for example, there are attorneys in disciplinary cases who really have committed criminal conduct, but they haven't been charged yet. Does OLR expect them to just lay out the case against them?
And again, I guess going back to my earlier comment about the Fifth Amendment, I know in civil proceedings, if you assert the Fifth, there is a presumption that it would not have been in your favor to answer it.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Mr. Kolb.
The first comment I'd like to make is with respect to the language of 22.03 sub 6. It requires a respondent to provide relevant information to answer questions fully or to furnish documents. There were no documents on the subject of the 14-foot easement. His knowledge came from personal conversations. This is a case that if you're going to find a violation of the duty to cooperate, you have to assume that he knew that Kurt Foster had told him and that he refused obstinately, irrationally, and against his own interest to disclose that information. Counsel for the OLR has used phrases like...
Or to assert that he might be running afoul of the attorney-client privilege by responding. He either could have, as you said, by not answering, he would have been acting against his own best interests if he had actually known. Or if he had known and was concerned about the attorney-client privilege, certainly could have raised that as a potential reason for failure to respond.
I'd like to, if that's a lifeline to me, I appreciate it. But I think that
you appreciate that point.
The Supreme Court rules, I think, allow you to otherwise disclose confidential information.
Is that? I was looking for it and couldn't find it.
In defense of an OLR proceeding.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Counsel for the OLR used phrases like somewhat evident, I'm speculating, it's my clear impression. These do not rise, and it emphasizes that you do not have clear, satisfactory, and convincing evidence here. The Erskine case that was addressed, in that case, the respondent refused to do something requested by the district committee. The only way you can analogize that to this case is if you assume that Roger Mary Holtwell had in mind the fact that his client had told him and refused to disclose that. This was 2 years after the fact. 2 years ago or 2.5 years ago, the following things happened, amongst others. Earthquake and tsunami damaged Japan and critically crippled the Fukuyama reactor. News came out that Ryan Braun had failed the drug test, and Muammar Gaddafi was captured and killed by Libyan rebels. I dare say you all know those facts. I also would venture to guess that nobody remembers exactly how they found out about it. For a lawyer's professional standing and ability to practice is at stake here. That's why you've set a higher standard. And the only thing that would support a finding of a violation of that rule is that you assume that he acted irrationally and failed to give a name when he had it in mind. If he didn't have it in mind, how can he be accused of a violation for saying, I don't know, but if you want to know the truth, call the heads of those agencies. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Well, I've said in numerous oral arguments relating to OLR cases, these are always very difficult for OLR, for the lawyer involved, and for the court. And we appreciate both of your arguments and your briefs in 11AP3009D, OLR versus Mary. This concludes our oral arguments as scheduled for the month of September, and the court is adjourned for oral arguments. This is our hearing on the Mary matter. The court will meet in a conference at 10 after 3. We are adjourned.